All right, again, we're in 2 Kings, chapters 10, and then also chapter 11, hopefully tonight, as we continue to look at really this middle period of the leadership of Israel and some of the things take place. Jehu is our primary first topic, and we kind of asked this question and partially answered it, I think, to some degree last week. Let me ask it again. If you had to use a short sentence to describe Jehu, who is now our leader in space, how would you describe him? A summary or a short sentence concept. Roy first. Man of war. Yeah, he's a trickster of a kind. You see him, but it's not so much sneaky as it is bold and not revealing. He's not telling people what his plans are all the time. What else?
I think he's a righteous judge, jury, and executioner.
Right. He is used as a multifaceted tool. I came up with, basically, he's a hard man. He's hardened. We don't get to see soft edges of him. Could they be there? The text doesn't show us that. It shows us a man who is willing to do things that, even in his context, are not done by everybody. There are compromisers that surround him. Not everybody is a man of war. Not everyone has their hands covered with blood like his eventually are. And yet, it's identified to us that he is obedient. That goes back into our space of him being used as judge, jury, executioner. Which leads me to this kind of interspace question. The Old Testament does not pull its punches with physical conflict at all. It's bloody. It's violent. In the teaching of Jesus, in his practical teaching, he disconnects from some of that. What's your thoughts about that distinct difference? He doesn't act like violence doesn't happen, but there's not much violence coming from him and from his disciples to others.
It's the difference in the kingdom between earthly and spiritual. We're fighting spiritual warfare, not a physical. We have the physical for an example to us, is how that worked and how God played into it. But it is totally different being spiritual. We are so fortunate to be living in the spiritual kingdom instead of in that other one.
There's a lot of you that really echoes that idea of, I'm glad to be here. But think about it this way. I was trying to put my hand around it, my head around it a little bit to say, now, what's God trying to teach us here? What should I learn beyond good kings, bad kings, obedient kings, disobedient kings? Israel as a people and as a nation serves in part as a nest or an incubator for an idea and an opportunity. The idea and the opportunity are resolved in Christ and the kingdom. But Israel is also a physical kingdom that God guides. So in the Old Testament, we get not only a vision of a spiritual kingdom, because Israel still is a spiritual kingdom, but we also see an earthly kingdom. In Christ, we have a king who supersedes all earthly kingdoms, but still interacts with earthly kingdoms. Pay your tax, be obedient to the law, understand that they have power given through me. They're the ones who have that role. But his kingdom shifts off of that incubator nest space and grows into its fullness, and so it separates. Then you more clearly see the differences that Les is talking about between earthly kingdoms and the heavenly kingdom, because the earthly kingdoms that we read about in the text
pretty much are only concerned with killing members of the spiritual kingdom. When you think about the Old Testament text, it's actually not that much different, because a lot of the violence that takes place is directed towards those who are trying to do right, to live righteously or be obedient to God's plan. Not all of it. Sometimes you have evil people fighting evil people. But a lot of it is actually in that same space. Except that Israel is a theocracy, which you have a physical king who is also leading them in a spiritual way. Because they have a law that encompasses both edges of its life. So let me go back to Jehu, who is being used in this particular way, because he's going from fulfilling a prophecy concerning a bad king and a bad family to one step further. So if we're thinking about chapter 10 now, and paying attention to verses, just for right now, 18 through 27, what takes place there? How would you summarize that section of the text? What's the conflict? You got Jehu. What's the other side of the conflict table? Some prophets, right? Prophets of whom? Yeah, so remember, Baal or Baal or Baal, however you're going to try to bring that Hebrew word, Aramaic word in English, and most folks will say Baal or Baal. This is a religious context, right? This is not about physical power. He's not trying to expand his kingdom. Nor is it solely, hey, there's a prophecy against this, I'm just following through with an expectation. He's really getting at what could be considered the heart of the real conflict in Israel. And think about how this would go today, if you think about it, how our culture responds to a large mass extermination of a population. What do we call it? Genocide, right? Sometimes in the light of war. That's not a thing that's gone away, by the way. Genocides exist in Africa, in Asia. They've existed in our near history as well. You look at the push westward of the American population as we moved westward. You had actual spiritual conflict that was resolved in earthly conflict. This is our land. Our great God gave us this land. That's the Native Americans. That's Geronimo. Then you have the Mormons and the greater American empire growing out saying, well, wait a minute, no. This is our land. And our God said that it was our land to take from you now. Same fights, right? Did they engage in genocide? Both of them sought to do so. So it's not just an Old Testament text thing. It's a human thing. So then we have to interact with it again and say, okay, what makes this one okay? If we know that genocides exist historically and they exist in the Bible, why is this one different than any of the ethnic conflicts that take place in Africa right now? All right, so now we're doing so on the assumption and conviction that God is, and he has the right to ask. Particularly, we're comfortable with it because, like we've already affirmed, I don't live then. It's not me. My hands don't get dirty. But the level of conviction we have to develop is one that's so trusting that says more than just technically say, yeah, God ordered that. I'm okay with it because that's what God needed then. And if he orders me to do something, I have that same level of commitment. We can still be thankful that we're not asked to do so. But Jehu's hardness might be something that's missing within us. Not so much the consequence of that kind of warring lifestyle, but the kind of conviction and zeal that drove it. Because that's the kind of conviction and zeal that can make us strong when others need us to be strong, and others might also include us. Les?
And that's what makes a difference in really kind of helps you to understand a little bit how Muslims are today, because they don't accept Christ or his kingdom. So they're still kind of going under these same rules that was back in those times, where anybody that doesn't believe what they believe is an infidel and worthy of death. And it don't make you like it, but it helped me to understand where they are.
Well, let's think about this now too, and this connects that principle to some degree as well. In chapter 10, in the beginning part of this, and this is part of the reason why we say Jehu is a trickster. Jehu assembled all the people and said to them, Ahab served Baal a little, but Jehu will serve him much. Now, there's some language play going on, by the way. You may not notice, but that's actually a little sarcasm, and the way that text is laid out, super cool in the language. And he is about to serve him much, right? But now think about Ahab for a moment. Ahab was the pinnacle of compromisers, right? Because did Ahab also seek to serve Elohim, Yahweh? Yeah, there were times he was actually like, seemed to be going that way. What always pushed him back? Jezebel, right? Because if Jehu only served Baal a little bit, Ahab only served Baal a little bit, it means he was serving someone else the rest of the time. Jehu comes in as a hard man and said this partial statement. But then he goes on, I have a great sacrifice to offer. And what was that sacrifice? All the worshipers and all the implement, like everything that would be part of the worship practice of the false gods. So in this very short period of time, he repeats the same kind of behavior. He creates a ring around those that show up and eliminates both the family of Ahab and followers, but also the false gods. And again, it's dirty, awful work from a physical standpoint. Whatever was started all the way back in 1 Kings 18 with Elijah now has been completed at the hands of Jehu. Does this mean everything's great for Israel? Everything should be perfect, right? What seems to be missing then?
They haven't done away with everything that's false that they're worried.
Right, they've got a leader willing to do the hard work of the leading side, but have their hearts changed?
No, not really.
Does the text show a lot of people rallying behind Jehu in this? Like a huge armada of Israelites going, yes, all the Baal worshippers are going to be gone. And yes, Ahab and his family will be gone. Do we see them just come out of the woodwork and just have parades of free expression of faithfulness to Jehovah? Bobby?
I don't think they knew what kind of worship he was talking about.
Oh, I'm sure that was pretty obvious that he was able to clearly identify one thing, but he was meaning another thing. And we can read that in the subtle nature of the text. Jehu will then reign in Israel. This is a kind of an echo of the kind of reigns you saw in Judges. Whether it was an Israelite or an outsider, the status quo lasted until that judge, in this case that king, was no longer able to maintain his power. And that would even include Samson to a degree with whatever he was doing. Like his standard, there's not going to be another one. You don't produce those on a regular basis. And Jehu himself follows that same model. But it's partially incomplete in that he doesn't fully commit himself, like Les pointed out, to helping all of Israel purge their worship, but also then seek to restore all of the righteous practice that should be taking place. Go back and actually do God's law in regards to caring for the land, maintaining the people. And the text will continue there through the end part of chapter 10, where Jehu's own death is recorded in the text. Jehu would reign over Israel for about 28 years. You think about that, 28 years post-Ahab. Things were better, right? But were they what God wanted for the people in the land?
Well, verse 30 says that the Lord praised Jehu, but and then he goes on to say that he didn't fully walk in his ways.
Right. You know, it's one of those cases where you're saying, look, he's come so far, but he didn't come far enough. That's a, by the way, it's also a rarity in the Bible where you see someone being praised for what we would consider a half measure. Good came of it, but it wasn't the full good that God was looking for. I thought it'd be good right now, before we go into chapter 11 tonight, should we have time, to pause for a second also and kind of put some other details up to kind of see where things are at. So this is half of what will be for tonight, a little timeline that lays out for us both the united and then now the divided kingdom. And we're actually just a little bit on that edge of the page, and we'll show the other half in a second. But these kingdoms here who have been united for so long, and you have that powerful Saul, David, Solomon time frame where they were able to accomplish much, have now deeply scattered and become a shattered people. Even in looking at what we've read so far in the text, we've seen Israel cycle through a number of leaders, from Jeroboam all the way now to Ahab. And then Judah, which will also be a focus for us going forward, has moved through these same cycles of rise and fall. With Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, and now Jehoram. That level of disconnect that's present for Israel will be a source of conflict all the way up until 722, which is the beginning of the captivity cycle that will take place going forward. Second half looks much like the first of this. We're going to see again this repeat in chaos, if you will. And this kind of just lays out for us how these things are sequentially presented. With, by the way, the numbers up here as to when they were kings is approximate, because there's some things that move plus or three a few years based on tidbits of history. And so your Bible notes may not exactly match up to these dates, but this is really close. It's a really close approximation of the sequence and the time frame for the kings of both what we consider the northern and the southern kingdom. And you're going to see something that takes place with more regularity during our next section of the text. More of Israel and Judah at odds with one another. Up till now, we've seen instances where they're willing to collaborate. That takes place less and less. One of the key sources of that establishment of practice had to do with where people worshipped. And so you find these kingdoms now centralizing their spiritual behavior as much as their earthly kingdom behavior. And that begins to further divide these people. When they come back to captivity, the secondary places of worship that were adopted during this time of conflict are never repopulated. They never return. They never really become sources of spiritual power for Israel in the latter portions of their history, post-return and post-Nehemiah and Ezra. Before we get into that section, though, do you guys have any questions or things you want to talk about for Jehu before we go into chapter 11? We've got a good 20 minutes of chapter 11, so...
I'm trying to keep up with the allegiance of all of these kings to God. Jehu, was he the eighth king?
For the kingdom of Judah, and we can back up there. We can see him in our little sequence here. Let me see if I can back it up. The way we normally count this is we count the separate kingdoms independent of the lineage. And so the first thing we would count was we got our first three kings overall, but only two in the line of David. And then Judah is what we would consider following the primary line. So that's going to be David, Solomon, Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram. And that would then move forward. Now, Israel is our top group. And for him, we're going to place him at like 10 in the Israelite kingdom. They would claim also legitimacy back to David and Solomon. But from the biblical line of kings, it's going to go through the kingdom of Judah as the line of kings that would lead to Jesus. Now remember, all of these groups, though, are all interrelated. All these lines of kings have a thread of legitimacy that ties them back to David. The question is, who is God's anointed? And what does that mean? Because you can be anointed and still not be part of the kingly royal line. So that's why I have to ask the second question, is what does that mean? So from that standpoint, we're looking at 10/12. They would consider it the 12th king. We tend to consider him the 10th king because we separate those segments out between Judah and Israel. We see now they're two different lists. Matthew?
Yeah, this one might be kind of hard, but I've thought about this often, but Jehu would be the topic to cover on is, where is the line of what is unrighteous versus righteous as far as violence against another man? Because we know that God doesn't change, and we see that sometimes violence is accepted, and we know times that violence isn't. We know that Jesus indicates to the apostles before he's taken, he says, get by a sword. If you, those who have enough, by a sword. And they say, here's two. And he says, that is enough. The Lord wouldn't command somebody to do something unrighteous, and we know that a man who carries a sword usually has two reasons, either to end peace or to keep peace. And it's always been kind of a difficult to me. It's always seemed as a difficult understanding of where that line is, because clearly there are times that the Lord has accepted violence, but mostly it's against a man who perpetrated evil. Obviously, violence is not accepted against an innocent man. And we're just, and even there's some evil people who the Lord condemns violence against when they are acting upon.
You are asking one of the most complicated questions of any age. Not only complicated, but I think it's certainly one of the most complicated. Here's why. There's also a third way to consider Jesus' instruction to the disciples to buy a few swords. And that is, he was trying to teach them something about the value of a sword. And what would that illustrate or mean? What's the picture supposed to be? Because it could be more than just, hey, you need this tool going forward, I won't be here. Which is one way to read it. So here's some things to think about. And I don't have all the answers, and I think I preached on this by request when I first got here, and it's never an easy subject. First answer to that is, in the Old Testament, under the law of God and the law of Israel, violence was sanctioned and requested. That's an absolute fact. Violence was directed towards, as you pointed out, evildoers, and at times engaging at a national level. And we know that in part because the age of a young man was identified at the time at which he could go out to war. So under the old law, God sanctioned violence at the national level. In Christ, you have Jesus teaching a combination of truths that you've talked about. Combination of truths that include governments still have a right to engage in national warlike behavior. And I say warlike is that they might be the judge of the unjust. They might be the ones who are the sword of accountability to general moral law. This murderer may go to jail. This abuser may go to punishment, etc. And an individual is the person who does that. Like, that's not just like an entity. The government does it. There is no government outside of individuals. So in the end, there's always somebody who is Jehu, who's that hard man. So let me ask, what does the Christian do? Because that's really the last step of this. Like, I know that it exists over here. I know Jesus allows for governments to have those roles. What do we do?
We have a choice.
We have lots of choices. And there's one emphasized choice that's hard to do. Knowing that this still is a lawful, legitimate role of government, there is a tone of the teaching of a text that says, go extra miles. Turn your other cheek. If someone wants your cloak, give him more. And so that has to be our first stopping point. Okay, we got to be willing to give rather than just be violent in response to someone takes. That doesn't mean we don't have an armed escort, because here's a balance to that. Who carried Paul around after he was accused of murder? Roman soldiers, like men of war. And how did he get that protective guard? He appealed to the lawful government agency and said, hey, do that. So they protected him from other evildoers as he made his way to make his case in Rome. So there's some level of balance there, but we still have a choice. We still get to choose. I wish there were super easy answers to some of this too. I just don't think that there are. On an individual basis, we get to make a choice and say, is this manifesting God's desire for me now? Government, yes. And I think Christians can serve in government and can serve the military. I will say this, and I've said it 100 times, those are hard jobs to do. And they will challenge your faith in ways that you probably will not find working in other areas. They're going to need more prayer, more support than they think they do, and we think they do. That's like the start of the conversation, Matthew. I wish I had really simple answers. That's like the start of trying to figure some of that out. Bobby, and then Les.
If you had to go to the military and you didn't think you could kill another person, you could be classed as a conscientious objector, and they would place you in a position where you wouldn't have to kill anybody.
And that's still a possibility for many military service individuals. One of the things they tell you, though, is there's no guarantees. If you are deployed forward and you are in a non-combat specialty, they can't guarantee that you'll never be in a situation where someone won't tell you to go and do things you didn't decide to do. And you just have to accept the consequences of disobeying that order if you're so convicted about it. Now, we also have one more complication living in America, and this is another important fact. American law in most states, even in states that you guys may not be super familiar with, allows the individual citizen greater leniency with physical violence than a lot of other nations do. And it's legal. It's lawful. That basic rule is kind of packaged under self-defense. You guys familiar with that rule, I'm pretty sure. And self-defense usually exists under two contexts. Violent aggressor towards you, or two violent aggressors. And the courts just determine, in the course of events, were they justified in defending themselves? Because there's an escalation of conflict between two people, and one person went up the scale higher than the other. Okay, now who gets to be the one in the right? That's also hard to source out.
First, I'll speak a little bit of my thoughts on where Jesus talked about asking for a sword. I personally believe that was to have that sword so Peter would have it to fulfill the scriptures when he cut off Malchus's ear. That's my thoughts on that. I don't think that Jesus planned on doing it for defense. They didn't need a sword for defense because they could call, he could call angels for them. That's just another way to kind of think about it. You never thought about it that way. And then as far as the other part about the military, the Amish are completely not expected to serve in the military because of their faith and how their faith is known to the government. They are exempt from serving in the military. So that tells me something about what our faith should be.
Well, I mean, we look at the Amish and we say that means our government understands there are going to be individuals who are not comfortable engaging in physical conflict.
And that's why they have the conscientious objector.
Right. And that's pre-Amish. That's every culture, actually, of the Western world has dealt with that in trying to figure out. In the history of Churches of Christ, by the way, if you go back 70, 80 years, you're going to find a strong pacifist, strong non-participation in government trend. Like, just leave me alone. Let me be faithful. I'm out of this government space. And that's not everybody by any means, but there's a strong push that way, predominantly up in Indiana and Ohio is where a lot of that really was strongest. So it's not an uncommon thing. It's not just an Amish thing. It's not a Mennonite thing. Baptists, there's notable servicemen across the history of the U.S. that come from all faith spaces that were conscientious objectors at one point, and sometimes they changed their mind, and sometimes they changed their mind back. I think it's Audie Murphy who went back and forth regarding his service, and there was another gentleman from Tennessee. Like, he had a movie made about him. It'll come to me in a second. It was a movie made in the 50s. It'll come. My brain shut down. Random movie thing, but he was actually a member of the church, and that's why that's sticking in my head for a bit. Bobby?
Have you ever watched a movie about Patton? General Patton?
Many a Patton movie has crossed my desk as well, and he's the opposite. He's mostly someone who saw war as a means to an end in a very way, and much more aggressive, more Jehu-like. So then what do we do for us? Because Matt's big question is a good one. What's the line? Like, when is physical violence okay? Because there are spaces where that's something that's discussed and examined. Number one I'm going to come with is to say that from the government standpoint, physical violence seems to be 100% justified towards evildoers. And in America, whether you like it or not, American policy has sublet part of that to the individual. That's how it is. And that's not maybe how you like it. Might not be how I like it. But that's how it is. In some states, it's even more specific. Some states have a legal terminology they use as a castle doctrine, where you have the legal right to protect your people and your stuff. Now, I'm pretty clear, for me at least, I don't care about my stuff. I guess just stuff. But people I care about. And so I understand the ruling on the side of caring about people. And you have to figure that out and make choices that you can go to bed with the next night. I'll tell you, having talked to a lot of individuals who have served in the military and served in law enforcement and been in positions where they've had to engage in actual conflict, that being at peace with it is hard. These are not just general populations, though many of them are just folks I know. Many of them are members of the church. What was it, Johnny Cash, who wrote that once you pull that trigger, you take away all that that man ever will be or ever was? That's an approximation of the verse. It's close enough. So you have to sleep with that. That's the far end of that, right? Violence exists lower than that. And deciding, okay, what's okay on that lower space is important too. And it's not easy. It's not as clear cut as that person there is condemned by God and God asked you to go and put them in the grave. That's easy to understand, hard to do. Some of you have probably been in positions where your life has been threatened, or you thought your life was being threatened. You want to go back to that space again? No, none of us do. But do you understand the fear that goes on a person's mind when that threat is there and your concerns raise up and all that takes place? Those are things we have to grapple with and figure out. And I'll tell you, when you figure it out, before it's an issue, not afterwards. And you got to really decide, what am I willing to live with? Those who engage in the training space of training people for this process, remind folks, there's actually three fights that take place. You may have heard it was two fights, but there's actually three. There's a physical fight where someone may survive the physical fight. There is the legal fight that follows. And everybody loses in the legal fight. There are no winners in the courts in regards to physical endeavors. But then there's the last fight, and that's a spiritual one. You want to have that one in order before you start the first and the second. I realize I might not have given great answers, Matthew.
No, it was an open-ended. You hope that there's an answer of, yes, this is right, God, this is fair, or whatever the situation. Yeah. Statement about Jesus' sword, I was using that more so as an example of something that is acceptable, that the Lord would not command something unrighteous. And what is his sword used for? Because early in that scripture, he says, let a man buy a sword. Yeah. If you have a one, buy one. So I only meant that it's
right.
Not saying that Jesus is saying, okay, you can go with the sword and whatever you need to do it for, but just the example is there.
Here's a great quote for you. And it might help on some of this. John Farnham, who some of you might know, but some of us may know, longtime educator in the space of personal defense and helping with military and police officers, says this: do not go to stupid places with stupid people to do stupid things. That's going to save 99% of your problems. All right? I'll add the last caveat. Don't be stupid. If you can accomplish those four steps, you have eliminated a lot of risk in your life. The Bible is actually really supportive of that same truth, if you think about the way it teaches us. He applies it specifically to physical altercations. I'll apply it generally to life. Don't go to stupid people, or don't go to stupid places with stupid people to do stupid things. The more we can live like that, probably be more likely to be at peace with all men as well. That's it for our class tonight. Really appreciate all the participation. Enjoy the discussion. The discussion then necessitated that we didn't get to get into chapter 11, which is absolutely okay. And so we'll do that in our next Bible study. At this time, though, we want to go ahead and